What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Thursday, June 12th. We had Game 3 of the 2025 NBA Finals last night, of course, between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Indiana Pacers in what was an awesome, awesome back and forth, high stakes, high level basketball game across the board. And the Pacers were able to win this one 116 to 107 to take a 2-1 lead against the heavy favorite Oklahoma City Thunder. So going to talk all things game three and where this series stands and where it goes moving forward. So with that said, let's go ahead and get right into it. So just to recap this game a little bit, we've got the same starting lineups we've had the whole series, with Cason Wallace still starting in place of the second big in Hartenstein. Indiana's obviously rolled with their same starting five pretty much all season long, especially in the postseason. Same matchups that we've seen throughout. And the Thunder jumped out to a quick 15-6 lead in this one, got off to a fast start. SGA was a little bit quiet early, but Chet had a really big first quarter. He had 12 of the team's first 19 points. He started the game 4-for-4 from the field, was making some impactful defensive plays as well. Lu Dort was 3-for-3 from three in the first quarter, so they were getting nice contributions from some of their secondary, tertiary guys. They shot 11-for-21 in the first, 3-of-5 from three, and found themselves up 8 points, 32-24 after the first quarter. But the Pacers punched back quickly in this one at the beginning of the second quarter in the non-Halliburton minutes, which were minutes that really, really cost them in game two. That was really the big run that ignited Oklahoma City into the big lead that Indiana just tried to chip away but could never make enough of a dent into. But in the second quarter, Indiana starts on a 15-4 run to regain the lead and got absolutely huge contributions, specifically from TJ McConnell and Ben Mathurin in this one. McConnell just in this quarter had 3 steals, 2 off of an inbound. He was a plus 15 in 8 minutes in the corner, was creating things, getting to the basket in a way that Indiana's really struggled to do so in this series so far. Mathurin comes off the bench after not playing a minute in the first quarter, 14 points on 5-of-6 shooting, was carrying the offense at times. SGA did come back in and started to cook a little bit at the end of the second, but the Pacers starters, once they were back in, did finish the quarter strong as well. Halliburton hit a few floaters here and there, and the Pacers found themselves up 64-60 at halftime in what was a 40-point quarter for them, which they've struggled to get to 40 points in the first half of the first two games. So to see them have that kind of offensive explosion against this defense was very encouraging for the Pacers, just to see that they still are capable of having those kinds of big outbursts against this defense. But into the third quarter, the Thunder immediately go on an 8-0 run to go from down 4 to up 4. Carlisle calls a timeout just a minute and a half into the half. But the Pacers fought back and they regained the lead in the third quarter. They were up 1 point with 52 seconds left. The Thunder finished the quarter on a 6-0 run just as they started the quarter to be up 5 entering the fourth quarter, 89-84. But the fourth quarter, the Pacers continued to fight back. It was a very back and forth fourth quarter, especially for the first half of it. The teams were tied at 98 at around the 7-minute mark in the fourth quarter before the Pacers just exploded down the stretch. They finished the game on an 18-9 run over the final 6:45 of the game to run away with this one. The Thunder really struggled late in this fourth quarter. In the last 5:25 of the game, they were 1 of 10 from the field, 0 of 4 from 3, 1 of 6 from 2-point range. They went only 5 of 8 from the free throw line. They got blocked on 5 different shot attempts, so half of their shot attempts down the stretch got swatted away by Indiana. And so the Pacers, as I mentioned in the intro, win this one 116-107 and go up 2-1 in the series. And there were a lot of factors in this game that played out very different from game two. And I didn't have time to put a podcast up for game two, but I'll just say that result wasn't overly surprising. I said I thought Oklahoma City would win game two after game one. I said I thought they'd win comfortably, and that's pretty much exactly what happened. We see this very often when the big favorite or home team loses game one at home, and then they come back to bounce back in a big way in game two just because a little bit of desperation kicks in. Not that the series would necessarily be over, but going down 0-2 with both games at home is obviously not ideal for anybody. And so we saw them punch back, and Indiana really had one of their worst games of the postseason. But hey, we've seen them have duds like that. Game three against Milwaukee, they lost by 15 plus. Game three against Cleveland, they lost by 15 plus. Game five against New York, they lost by 15 plus. So they've had a couple of these games, and all of those games, it was the same kind of thing where they just came out a little flat. They didn't shoot the ball particularly well. Their stars weren't doing star things. And again, it happens. You're not going to have a perfect game every game, especially against a team like Oklahoma City with how good they are. But in this game, we saw them bounce back in a really, really nice way and look a lot more like how they've looked throughout the majority of this postseason. Number one, Haliburton was way more assertive in this. I know that there, a lot of the narratives were that he needs to be more aggressive and that he's a little too passive. And I think some of those stuff is a little unfair just because that's just not really his style of play. Haliburton is the kind of guy that plays in the flow of the offense. He doesn't force things. Like, I agree that he probably needs to be taking more shots. And that was one of the key swing factors I listed in the finals preview that I put together. But it's not like he's really turning down a bunch of shots. Like, he's just doing what he does. He's making the right pass, making the right play. And so I it wasn't like I was like, oh my God, Haliburton looks like he's scared to shoot out there. It's like he was playing within the flow of the offense. But that doesn't mean that to an extent they're not right, that he does need to be more assertive. He does need to look for his shot a little more, and not just his shot, but he needs to look to be super involved as a playmaker, because this season they are 20-1 when he has 20 plus points and 10 plus assists, which he had that in this game three with 22 points, 11 assists, 9 rebounds, just a rebound shy of a triple double on 90-17 shooting. And again, after game two, he had 17-6 on 7-for-13 from the field, which is going to look not that bad in retrospect. But through three quarters of that game, he had only 5 points and 4 assists on 2-7 shooting. So in the fourth, he had 12 points, 2 assists on 5-6. So the game was pretty much out of hand at that point. It was a little bit of a stat paddy type situation. It was not a good game for him across the board. He only had 12 total assists in the first two games combined, 11 in this one alone. He still does not have a free throw attempt in the series, which is kind of bizarre, but that felt right for the first two games at the very least, because he wasn't making any effort to get downhill. He wasn't attacking the basket, penetrating into the paint very often. But in this game, he did a little bit more of that. And not that he was getting to the basket a ton, but he was really going to that floater game that he is honestly, he has that shot in the bag and he probably should look to shoot it more often. But he had 3 or 4 different times where he got a floater off and made it in this one. He was firing from three in a way that was a little different from what he normally does. Typically, his threes come either on a step back and a mismatch or off a catch and shoot, just from a kick out because he's wide open. But in this one, he was doing a little bit more just straight up off the dribble type shooting from three, where if he had even just a little space of breathing room, he was just willing to pull up, which that's the kind of things they need out of him. And so those are the shots that people have been saying, okay, we need you to be ready and willing to shoot those shots, because he's a damn good shooter and they need him to score for this team if they want to win this series and win a championship. And so I just thought him being so much more involved, maybe as a playmaker, is even more important than as a scorer. Having those 12 assists in this game, it means the offense is chugging along and they're getting good shots and role players are knocking down those shots. So he clearly had more of an intent on getting a shot in this game, and it paid dividends for them. They also obviously got tremendous bench contributions in this one. I touched on this a little already during the recap, but Ben Mathurin, 27 points on 9-of-12 shooting in this game, in 22 minutes. He was a plus 16. He got to the line 8 times, went 7 of 8 from the line. He had 10 points in the fourth quarter, and he was carrying this group offensively at times. Like, in the minutes where he was out there with no Haliburton, they were completely running the offense through him, and he was thriving. And Mathurin, he's only 22, and he's had a little bit of an up and down career to this point. Showed some really nice flashes as a rookie out the gate, but then really struggled down the second half of that season. His second season kind of regressed a little bit, ended up having that season ending injury, so wasn't even able to play in the playoffs last year. And then this year, he bounced back better than his first year, a little bit more efficient across the board, but still maybe not the leap you would have hoped. But I will say, when this guy's on, he shows legitimate flashes as a high, high, high level scorer, creator, initiator. His shot making is pretty much unlike anybody else on this Indiana roster. And again, the consistency is not always there with him. He kind of makes boneheaded plays sometimes. His decision making could use a little bit of work along with that consistency. But when he's on, he is as good a scorer as Indiana has, and a guy that could score 20 to 30 plus points any given night. And so that's the kind of talent this guy has. And I've always thought that for Indiana to reach their full potential, he was a guy that needed to really step up and be the secondary scorer and a creator on offense, because Indiana, they're obviously a by committee a team, and that of course that has worked for them in this playoff run. But before we saw this proof of concept of what they are right now, it felt like they maybe needed one more kind of offensive weapon that could consistently generate offense for them. And he is such an interesting curveball from what they have across the rest of this roster. And they don't win this game without him. They don't have a chance in this series if he doesn't put up that kind of performance in this game. So kudos to him. But TJ McConnell also was just awesome in this game. 10 points, 5 assists, 5 steals in 15 minutes. He had 3 different times where he stole the inbound directly out of bounds. And aside from the steals, I thought McConnell's just ability to get into the paint, penetrating the defense, was such a difference maker. That's something that they have really, really struggled at in this series. A lot of stuff happening on the perimeter throughout it. But he just set the tone by getting into the paint and getting good looks for everybody, himself and other people. And he's really been the person who's most consistently been able to do that in this series for Indiana. So awesome TJ McConnell game. I mean, it was just him at his peak. Pesky as hell, annoying on both ends of the court, and again, just great contributions for him. I also thought Obi Toppin had a really nice game, only 8 points, 6 rebounds on 4 of 8, but impactful minutes, 2 blocks, some really key rebounds, and always in the right spots. It feels like filling the lanes on the offensive end of the court. Had the huge momentum, put back dunk to, I won't say seal it, but it was a big part of that run that they used to eventually go on to win this game. He was a plus 18 in 28 minutes, and he's become so important to this team due to their lack of depth behind Turner at the center position. He allows them to go small ball where they don't really have to play Thomas Bryant if they don't want to. I've advocated to cut the Bryant minutes altogether. He only played 3 minutes in this one, so clearly trending down on his playing time in this series. I think Carlisle is starting to realize that they can get away with not playing him, and that those minutes were not so good in this series anyway. But I kind of mentioned this when I talked about McConnell as well, but I thought another big thing that Indiana did in this game compared to the other games on the offensive end, and it was to me the reason why they looked just exponentially better and more comfortable on the offensive end compared to the first two games, even game one that they won. The majority of that game, it was a lot of stuff on the perimeter, but I thought they did so much better getting into the paint. Their shot diet across the board was just way better. There was so much dribbling around the perimeter in game one and game two, and a lot of side-to-side movement, not a lot of north-south. They just could not get in the paint when they did. There was defenders there waiting for them. They had a lot of turnovers when they tried to do it, so they kind of just stopped trying to do it. And that led to just not great shot selection. It's really hard to generate super good looks when all you're doing is moving the ball around the perimeter and dribbling. And that's just not really Indiana basketball, but that's how they had looked in the first two games. Game two, they only had 9 field goal attempts at the rim, which is a very low number. That's 5th percentile in terms of all NBA teams across the whole season. But again, three, they had 23. So that is a huge difference from the 9 they had in game two. And it's not just that penetrating to the basket obviously gets you more shots at the basket, but it helps you get looks everywhere else. You know, they had so many times where someone would drive to the basket, and then as they were driving in, someone from the weak side would cut to the basket, and then they had a little nice dump off pass. They had that happen multiple times throughout this game. And those are the kind of easy baskets that you can generate from getting into the paint like they did in this one. Additionally, they've taken plenty of threes in this series, which of course is not necessarily a bad thing because they do have a lot of good shooters. And that's one sort of win on the margin thing they can do against this Oklahoma City team. But not all threes are created equal. You know, dribble, dribble, one pass to the wing from three. That's often not a very good shot versus when you're driving to the paint and the defense collapses and reacts to the penetration, and then you can kick out to guys that are open. They swing to find the open shooter. Like, they got a lot more of those types of jump shots in this game, which are the exact kind that you want. I also thought it opened up the mid-range a little bit more. We saw Halliburton get more room to operate getting floaters in this one, whereas it felt like they were just settling for long two-point jumpers and not super great shots from three in the first couple games. So that was a huge thing for me. To me, that it was night and day with this offense. They need to continue to do this if they want to have a chance. They cannot revert back to just living on the perimeter like they have in the previous games. But ultimately, I think the way they won this game, the number one reason was their defense, because they were just so awesome, especially down the stretch of this game. They really, really bothered Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in this one. I mean, he got his 24 points, but for him, you know, he averaged like 32, 33 in the regular season. So that's even though 24 seems like a decent number, that's well below what he's been at both for the regular season and the postseason. I mean, he had over 70 points in the first two games combined, 38 and 34 respectively. But in this one, as I said, 24 points, 9 of 20 shooting, so not the most efficient. 6 turnovers compared to only 4 assists. I think that is a number that really tells the story of the discomfort that he had in times of this game. That was the second most turnovers in any game that he had this season. The fourth quarter, where he's been so good in some of these other games and series, he was only 3 points on 1 of 3 shooting. And just Nembhard and Nesmith have just done such a good job on him, particularly Nembhard, who's been the primary guy on him. When Nembhard has guarded him in this series, he's forced 5 turnovers, and SGA is shooting only 7 of 20 from the field, which is 35%. When Nesmith's guarding him, he's shooting only 5 of 14, which is 35.7%. So when those two guys have been on him, he is 12 for 34, which is 35%. And he's 22 for 37 when everybody else guards him, which is 59%. So he's basically cooked everyone else. But those two dudes have done such a good job. We've already talked at nauseam about Nesmith's ability to fight over screens. But Nembhard has played Shai better than maybe anyone I've ever seen him. I know people keep talking about this like Canada connection. They're from the same area and stuff, so they know each other well. But I don't know. He just like anticipates his moves so well. And Shai is so polished with, you know, his footwork and his head fakes. And just usually he could just lull defenders to sleep with his creativity on offense. But it just feels like Nembhard like will beat him to the spot and like doesn't go for his up fakes and just cuts him off right before he gets to the basket. And so I don't know. He's played him so well. He's physical. He's getting in his chest. He's forcing him into difficult spots on the court. Like a lot of times where down the stretch of this game where he ended up like 18, 20 feet out from the basket, but like right on the baseline, just a really tough shot to get good looks from. And then they also have had really timely doubles, especially in this game. Like they weren't just instantly blitzing, but they were being cognizant of the shot clock. Once it got down to like 3 or 4 on some of these possessions, then they're starting to throw guys at him, because even if he does somehow get a pass off, there's not going to be a lot of time to swing and get a good look. So I thought they just guarded him so well, especially in that fourth quarter. And they've also done a pretty good job of not fouling, especially in this game, where he had 6 free throw attempts, which is, you know, I mean, not nothing, but below his average. And like I said, they've just been disciplined in not going for some of his crafty moves that has got him the reputation of a foul merchant. Also, even though Turner was really bad in this game offensively for the majority of it, he was so massive for them down the stretch in the key run that won them the game. Just late in this game, he had 3 separate blocks on Chet in the final 5 minutes of the game. The team had 5 blocks overall in the last 5.5 minutes, and Chet has just looked overmatched physically at times in this series, in my opinion. I know he got off to the quick start in this one, but even with that, he ends up 6-for-15 from the field. So after his 4-for-4 start, he went only 2-of-11 the rest of the game. That was after going 2-for-9 in game one. He had a fine game two, but I just feel like late in these games, he can't physically get to his spots. He's getting bullied by Indiana's big men, and I feel like there's a little something missing from Chet at this point in his career. I know he's so young, and I don't doubt that he can get there, but I'm not sure what his niche is offensively at this point, because sure, he can stretch the floor a little bit, but he's not some knockdown shooter from outside. You know, he's a good shooter, but not a great shooter. And these days, a lot of centers can shoot from outside, so I wouldn't say that's some superpower that he has offensively. But he's still frail and thin, and he does get bullied at times down low by bigger guys like Miles Turner. For example, Chet in this series with Turner guarding him is 6-for-19, which is 31.6%. He's been blocked by Turner 6 times. So he's taken 19 shots. He's made 6 of them and gotten blocked 6 times. So he's getting blocked as many shots as he's taking against Turner. And so, again, I just feel like physically he hasn't been up to the task in this series, and that has made a difference for them. And again, like, his offensive niche, what is it? He's a pretty good passer, not an elite passer. Pretty good shooter, not an elite shooter. He obviously isn't a back-to-the-basket, score-in-the-post kind of guy. So again, Chet is extremely talented, and he's still so young, so he's got a lot of time to figure out where he fits into modern NBA and where he fits into the pecking order on the Thunder or wherever he ends up spending the majority of his career if it's not here. But I'm just saying, as currently constructed, we're evaluating the Thunder for who they are right now because they are in the NBA finals and big favorites. And so I just feel like the current version of Chet is still leaving a little bit to be desired as a third, sometimes has to be second fiddle for Oklahoma City. But I thought overall, not only just Chet, but the whole Thunder team really got worn down in this one. The Thunder, by the end of this game, were standing around on loose balls and rebounds, just kind of watching dudes with hands on their knees. They looked tired as hell, and that's for a number of reasons. I think the Pacers wore them down with their pace and their physicality, because like I mentioned with SGA, how they've been guarding him really well. They also made him work like hell defensively in this game. He was the closest defender on 23 shots by the Pacers in this game, which was the highest amount for any game this season for the Thunder. So they were very persistent in putting him in the action over and over and over. And it's just really hard to guard every single possession against like high-level scorers and players like Haliburton and Siakam, when you also have the expectation and responsibility to, you know, score 30 to 35 points and be the go-to guy on the offensive end. And so to put him in that action over and over and over again, I thought it wore him down. I thought it's a part of why he didn't play great offensively. I also thought it's a part of why the Pacers were able to be more effective scoring in this game, because look, SGA is a good defender, if not a really good defender. But again, it's just a lot to ask out of a guy when we see this time and time again where the go-to scorer starts their career as a really, really good defender. The more responsibility they take on, the less they sort of put in effort on that end, and they kind of take a step back to role players who tend to run with that part of the defensive game plan. And so Shea's capable. Don't get me wrong. He's a good defender, but when you're guarding every single time down the court, it's just really easy to get worn out. And he played 42 plus minutes in this game, and this is the highest intensity, most physical environment that you're going to play in the NBA because it's the NBA finals. So it makes sense. But they didn't just wear him down with that. They wore him down with their pace too, because they actually won the turnover battle in this one. The Pacers did. They had 14 to the Thunder's 19, which, by the way, was the second most turnovers the Thunder have had in a game all season long. They had 20 against the Pelicans back in December, but playoffs or regular season, this was the second most. And so if you're the Thunder, you cannot afford to turn the ball over that many times against this team, because we know how deadly they are in transition. And this was by far their best transition game. I mean, not only from a frequency of getting out in transition, but also from an efficiency standpoint. Game one, they had transition possessions on about 13% of their possessions, only 8.7% in game two. And then in this one, they were up to above 17%. So by far the most they were able to get out in transition. But from efficiency standpoint, they had 100 offensive rating game one in transition, which is a really low number for Indiana. They had a 75 offensive rating game two. So not only did they barely get out in transition, they were awful when they did. But in this game, they had 135 offensive rating in transition. So, you know, close to one out of five times they were being able to push the ball, and they were scoring efficiently as hell when they were doing so. And so look, they just tired out this Thunder team, and that's what Indiana has done. It happened to the Knicks game six in that closeout game. The Knicks just weren't even bothering to get back on defense because they were so worn down and tired. And so Indiana just did a great job of wearing them down with their physicality and their pace in this one. For the Thunder, in terms of adjustments, I think there's a few things they could maybe tweak. I think it would be silly for them to, you know, deviate too much from what's got them here. They're an 80 win team on the season to this point. Like, they clearly have done things right. And so I think they need to stick to a lot of their philosophies and processes that have got them to this point. But there obviously are some tweaks here and there that I think could potentially benefit them. So first one, I think they need to continue to attack the Pacers' bigs more, specifically Miles Turner in the pick and roll, because I think the Pacers have largely been like awesome defensively, especially in this game. Game one, I thought they were really good down the stretch, especially in that second half as well. But the one thing that I feel like Oklahoma City has been able to really successfully exploit is the Turner and Thomas Bryant as well in the pick and roll. I mean, Bryant's minutes are dwindling, so this is more targeted at Miles Turner. When Turner's in the game, I think they need to go at him every time down the court, just like Indiana was going at SGA. Shea is 6-for-8 when Turner has guarded him in this series. And of course, those are all on switches, primarily in the pick and roll. And so those are the types of offensive possessions that have been super successful for them in this series. I think that the Pacers' bigs to this point have been playing up a little too high on some of the screen and rolls. They're not full blitzing, but they're also not dropping. And so they're doing this kind of in between where they're coming up a little to not let the guy fully just go around the screen, but it's not been super effective in my opinion. And I feel like they need to either commit to blitzing and hedging hard, or just play sort of more of a drop coverage, which honestly, I think could work against Oklahoma City. I mean, they have some good shooters, but they don't live and die by the three. Like Shea, for as good as he is, three-point shooting is actually one of the weaker parts of his game. But if you're Oklahoma City, I do think this is probably the number one strategy for them to go at offensively. Attack Miles Turner, go at the bigs in the pick and roll, because that's been effective to this point. And I feel like they kind of got away from it down the stretch of this game when it had worked so well. Second thing, I think maybe they got to consider starting and closing with Caruso over Cason Wallace. Wallace, I love him as a player. I think he is going to be a really good NBA player for a really long time. And I think he's currently a really good player and a great defender and solid two-way guy, good role player for this team. But he hasn't been great in this series. They are a minus 5.2 net rating wise with him on the court in this series, which is the lowest of every Thunder rotation player. He hasn't made a single three-pointer in this series. And the biggest thing with him is that they've attacked him a lot in mismatches. They've tried really hard to get switches onto him, specifically early in these games with him guarding Pascal Siakam. And Siakam's 5-for-8 when Wallace has been on him in this series. But I think honestly, the most concerning part of that is not that the percentages, but it's that he's had 8 shots when Wallace is guarding him. There's only 5 other individual matchups in this series with the Thunder guarding players that have more volume than that. So that's obviously not a matchup the Thunder are going to want. Siakam has bullied him down there. Conversely, when Caruso has guarded Siakam, he's only 2 of 6 from the field. We know he's a lot better at guarding up. We saw it against Randall. We saw it against Jokic. We've seen it really throughout his career. And so I think Caruso's just less mismatch susceptible, especially against Siakam, than Wallace is. And so I think that's been a weak point for the Thunder in some of these matchups. And I think that Caruso, he still brings everything that Wallace brings, essentially, when they put him in that starting lineup. I mean, he's been a more consistent shooter than Wallace in the postseason at this point. For as good as a defender as Wallace is, Caruso's still better than he is there. He's also a little bit more of a reliable, consistent ball handler, which I think is probably why they like him off the bench when one of J-Dub or SGA is out of the game. It just gives them another guy they can trust with the ball. But still, I mean, you can never have too much ball handling in your starting lineup, obviously. And so I do think that Caruso over Wallace would probably be my choice if you're going to go with the one big starting lineup. Another thing, I feel like they need to do a better job of getting Jalen Williams and Shai going at the same time. I feel like their games are not often very intertwined. It's a lot of your turn, my turn, where they kind of take turns running the action. One of them has the ball as the pick and roll ball handler. The other one does on the next possession, but they're very rarely in the action together. You don't see a lot of Williams coming up and setting a screen on SGA. And I think that's probably because they're matchup hunting. You know, they've got Siakam on J-Dub. So why you don't really want to put Siakam of all people in the screen when you could put Turner in it, for example. But they haven't done any inverted pick and rolls either with SGA setting screens for J-Dub. And I think they should worry less about the matchup sometimes and more about who's involved. That's their two best players, their two best offensive weapons, and defenses are going to have to pick and choose and commit one way or the other when they are both involved in that action. And so I do feel like we see a little bit too much of them not playing cohesively. And so I think that's another thing they could look to address. The other obvious ones, I already kind of touched on these, you know, they just need to be better in transition with their defense. They allowed Indiana to be way too efficient scoring in the transition. They also allowed them to get out in transition too often. And a lot of that had to do with their turnovers, which they need to take better care of the ball and be able to handle that pressure better, because they cannot afford to get out possessioned by Indiana. Because Indiana is just, for how good of an offensive team they are, for as efficient of a shooting team they are, they have consistently outshot their opponents in every single playoff series over the past 2 seasons. That's a sample size of 7 different series. So we know they're going to shoot the ball well over the large sample of a full series. So if you're Oklahoma City, you cannot afford to give them more possessions. You have to win that part of the battle if you want to be able to compete with them offensively. And then lastly, and this is an obvious one, but they just can't let Indiana hang around. And I know that that's the hardest thing to do in basketball right now, is to not let the Pacers hang around, because that's all they do. Even if when they get down, they find a way to claw back and make it interesting late, but they just cannot let them hang around. They need to keep their foot on the gas, put them away when they can earlier in these games, like they did in game 2, where they built the lead up big enough where even if Indiana made a little bit of a spurt, it would have taken a full utter collapse for them to blow that game. But you can't have these games like game 1, where, you know, they just let them kind of stay in that 10 to 12 range until crunch time. And then that's when Indiana is at their best. And we saw it again in game 3, where OKC gave up their early lead, were only able to build it back up to around 5 entering the fourth quarter. And then from there, like, they're just not going to out execute this team down the stretch very often, because most teams aren't. And if you just look in this series in the fourth quarter, Indiana has 143 offensive rating. OKC only has a 100 offensive rating. If you look in just the clutch time, Indiana has a 162.5 offensive rating, and OKC has a 50 offensive rating. So the higher stakes, the later in these games that it gets, the more Indiana has thrived. And this is not surprising. This is one of the things I called out in my preview, said if Indiana wants a chance, they got to keep these games close because that's when they're going to be at their best. And if OKC wants to make this series short work, then they need to pull away early in these games. And they were kind of able to do it in game two, but they have not in the other two games. And so I really think that, of course, it sounds silly saying an adjustment is to beat the other team by more points than you have currently. But again, that's just, we know they're capable of it and they've got to keep them at arm's length, which they just have not been able to do. So ultimately, the next question is, should the Thunder be worried? I mean, they're down 2-1 in the finals with Indiana having two home games to win a championship to close this thing out at home. And my answer is at this point is definitely not. Where it's still way too early in this series. I mean, if you check Vegas, they are minus 230 favorites to still win this series, which is pretty heavy favorites, especially for a team that's down 2-1. I mean, they've been double digit favorites in the two home games. They were like 5.5, 6 point favorites on the road in game three, and it's the same in game four going in. So Vegas expects them to still easily come back to win the series. And there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic if you're them, even though you're down 2-1. They've led for 112 total minutes of this series compared to Indiana only leading for 22 minutes. So they've led for 78% of the series thus far. They've thoroughly outplayed them overall. Indiana has just made big plays when it's mattered down the stretch of some of these closer games. Oklahoma City's outscored Indiana in the first quarter, in the second quarter, in the third quarter. It's really just been the fourth quarter where Indiana's made their runs in this series to this point. And the other part of this is like they were just in this exact scenario against Denver in the second round. They win game one on a game they kind of blew, a weird finish with a buzzer beater that kind of stunned them at the last minute. Then they blow out the other team in game two at home. Then game three, they lose a close one in what was a fun back and forth game. And then in game four in that series, they won a close one on the road. They won a close one at home in game five and went on to win the series in seven. So this is nothing they haven't been through before, literally just in the last couple weeks. You know, they were in this identical scenario. So they did it against Denver. Of course, it appears Indiana's a better team than Denver. So you could argue it'll be a little harder for them to pull off the same sort of thing, but I believe in them still. Also, if you just look historically, there's been four times this century where the team that did not have home court advantage went up 2-1 in a finals. And three of those four series, the higher seed, better record team went on to come back. The 22 Celtics were up 2-1 to the Warriors. They didn't win that series. The 2015 Cavs were up 2-1 against the Warriors. They did not win that series. The 2013 Spurs were up 2-1 against Miami. They did not win that series. The only one that's successfully pulled it off after being up 2-1 was the 04 Pistons, which again, feels like the 04 Pistons are an outlier for literally everything and every stat you want to pull up. But the point is, OKC shouldn't be worried. They just have to take care of business in game four. And if they do so, they'll be tied 2-2 heading home in a best of three series with two games at home left. So they should feel okay about where they're at, but they obviously do need to take care of business in game four. But I will say this is the first time where I really feel like the Pacers can win the championship. They're up 2-1 in the finals against a team that is 81-20 on the season, that's had a net rating above plus 10 all year long, that has the MVP, that's heavy favorites, minus 700 to win this series, betting favorites in Vegas. And here they are, up 2-1. They are two wins away from winning the championship. And so Indiana, at no point during the season has anyone really thought they could win the championship. Definitely not preseason, not when they got off to their 10-15 start, not when they finished up the regular season with 50 plus wins, not when they won the first round, not when they won the second round. I don't even think many people really thought they could win it when they won the conference finals and made the finals. And there's still not a lot of people who believe they can right now, even though they're up 2-1. And so while I still think the Thunder have a really good chance, and gun to my head, I still probably think Oklahoma City wins this series. I do genuinely believe, probably for the first time, that Indiana can win this series. They can win the championship. It is within their wheelhouse. Like, they are a championship caliber team, and they're worthy of winning a championship, whether they win this series or not. They've had that kind of season. They have proven against top competition that they are as good as anybody in this league right now. And there's a lot of reasons to feel good if you're them, aside from the fact they're obviously up 2-1. I mean, they've been outshot from three in this series. They have 16 more turnovers than Oklahoma City does in the first three games. They have 18 less free throw attempts. Halliburton still hasn't attempted a single free throw in the series. Siakam's not shot the ball well, 45% from the field, 25% from three. Turner hasn't shot the ball well. Like, there's a lot of things that haven't gone perfectly for them. So to still be here up 2-1 with two home games, all you got to do is win two games at home and you're NBA champions. It is just, you couldn't ask for a better situation to be in if you're Indiana. But I will say they cannot get complacent in game four. They have to go for the kill shot. They have to try to make sure game six is a closeout game on their home court, because I think it's going to be really tough for them to win a game seven on the road against this level of team. We saw how tough it was for Denver. It was a blowout from the start. And so they've got to go for the kill shot, just like they did against Cleveland, just like they did against Milwaukee, just like they did against New York. They won game four in all three of those series to go up 3-1. And I really think if they want to win this series, they kind of have to win game four, which, it's, of course, it sounds silly. 2-2, why wouldn't they be able to still win it? But I don't think you want to be in a scenario where you've got to win two out of three with two of the games on the road. And, of course, they're capable of winning on the road. They've been great on the road this whole postseason. But Oklahoma City is a different animal from the other teams they've played to this point. And so I really think game four is kind of a must-win for both teams. Like, I think whoever wins this next game is going to win the series and win the championship, just because I think it's going to be really tough to beat Indiana three times in a row. They haven't lost two in a row since March. So to think that they could lose three in a row would be really tough for the Thunder. But if you're Indiana, it's also going to be really tough to win two out of three with two of those games on the road, going back to Oklahoma City, when we've seen them be in this exact same scenario and handle business against another championship level team in Denver. So we'll see. I kind of think Oklahoma City is going to win game four and still win this series in six or seven. But again, I'm done ruling Indiana out. I've obviously been a believer, but not to this extent. I think they can win game four. I think they can win this series, and I think they can be NBA champions. But again, game four is going to be just pivotal for them and pivotal for Oklahoma City if either team wants to win this series. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Game four is tomorrow. Probably by the time you're listening to this, it'll be today on Friday. And so, like I mentioned, super, super important game four, could basically decide the series in my eyes. So very excited to see how it plays out. We'll have a recap of that game and talk about the series and where it currently stands after that one as well, before we get to game five beginning of next week. So with that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will chat with you soon.